Hello, everybody. This is the Second Society Project, and this is David Schmidt in conversation with Joe Atwell. Hello, Joe. How are you doing?
I'm just fine, Dave. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. So, Joe, there's a lot of topics that we can talk about today. Just so the readers have the table of contents of what we want to talk about, I think we should talk about Dr. Van den Bosch. We should talk about the interruption of medical screening and care, and the report coming out of Canada from their statistical agency about the effects of the lockdown. Specifically about my own little adventure into the need for PCR screening and the cycle count, a little talk on propaganda, and then also student groups. Okay,
that sounds great. Let's start off by your comments on we talked about it the last podcast, but I don't think we quite finished the topic. Boschen? How do you pronounce his last name?
Van den Bosch.
Okay, Van den Bosch. What are your opinions now of the claims that he made, which are so extraordinary?
Well, I think we should be cautiously interested in what he is saying. He is saying quite simply that the current current assortment of vaccines in our toolkit, in our doctor's bag, are inappropriate for use in the midst of a pandemic. So mass vaccination with what are really prophylactic agents is inappropriate, and the reason they're inappropriate is that they will promote, according to Van den Bosch, and he believes that can already be seen, they promote viral escape. And so what is this? This is the development of variants by the virus. And it's a development of variants for which the vaccines that are available are no longer keyed towards. They're not specific. They're no longer as efficacious against these. And how does that happen? It happens because, according to Van den Bosch, it happens because when you mass vaccinate, especially the young, who tend to have robust and effective immune systems, you are circumventing an important division of the immune system. So the immune system that we have is one in which mammals in particular and even birds some extent, it has different layers to it. And the first layer, you could think of it as the moat around the castle, is the innate immune system. And then the more elaborated part of our immune system inside the castle or up on the castle walls, if you need that kind of imagery to help, that elaborated immune system involves antibody production that can be very specifically fine-tuned and targeted against a certain type of strain that might be infecting our bodies. So when you circumvent that initial immune system, remember that needle jab is the first part of circumventing that, because that innate immune system is usually closely tied, or at least part of it is closely tied to our protective covering of skin or the mucus linings in our respiratory in the nasal cavities and so on. Then the next aspect of this is that young people have these very strong innate immune systems, which are generalized. They work against just a wide variety of different organisms and different viruses and different virus strains of the same species of virus. So you want you want that sort of immune system to be your first wave, okay? And again, just like with certain bacterial infections, if all you're fighting it with is something very specific, you are inviting those pathogens to micro-evolve around whatever weapon you're using against them. And this brings up another point. We talked about it in our early podcasts, which is not only do we have an immune system personally, that you could also think of our fellow conspecifics, our fellow humans, as also their immune systems representing, along with ours, a kind of ecological front, okay? And there are people that are even good people on our who we kind of ally with in this struggle against the totalitarian medicine, who criticize the sort of war theory or germ theory under, and this I disagree with, because in fact we are in a struggle with microorganisms, and again back to my point. Not only do we have an individual immune system, our immune systems collectively can be thought of as an entity that is in this struggle, and it even crosses species because there's generalized and specific effects in this struggle. So that's why some viruses can cross species, or some bacteria are able to cross between species as veterinarians have to be careful, because some diseases, are zoonoses. They go back and forth. So you see this, so it relates to what Van den Bosch said, in that he's saying that, you don't want to be mass vaccinating and dumping these vaccines on young people, because not only do you circumvent their very necessary innate immune system, but then you're inviting the older and the medically frail in some way to be overcome by the organism's ability to evolve around whatever the specific agent is. And then it brings up something else that we should keep in mind, which is that we've created an aging population. This deserves a whole separate topic someday. Especially the white Europeans have been duped into having these tiny family sizes. The giant contraceptive push that really the white Europeans have gravitated towards, differentially compared to other peoples around the world. Other peoples around the world have some more sanity about this. And so when you have a relatively low number of young people in your population, you're getting rid of some of your best immunological defenders in this ecological tension that we have with the pathogen. So that's about what I have on that topic. The other thing is, just to close it out, is regarding Geert Vandenbosch. I mean, he he keeps close ties and is an employee, if you will, of some of these big vaccine makers. So let's just be careful that we're not being led down a road by a Pied Piper. I don't mean to even say that he necessarily does this intentionally. It's just when you're trained like that, I could foresee the possibility that at some point, months from now, Geert Vandenbosch might be used to usher in the next level of vaccination on other premises. And, you know, as we've been talking about consistently, my concern with these vaccines, and of course there's the personal level, you know, the harm it might do to young people, the reproductive capacity, etc. But my big concern isn't that, you know, some 93-year-old guy with six comorbidities already might pass away 3 weeks earlier. My big concern is that the nucleic acid products, such as these mRNA and DNA products, the adenoviruses, etc., that these are really a platform at some point for introducing genetic changes in other systems unrelated to immunology. So you see, by introducing these things, one, just accidental in an Aristotelian sense, because it's very much planned, but accidental regarding their properties. One of the features of the current crop of genetic tools that they're using here, it involves the immune system and what you could call vaccination eventually. But really the goal is, and Moderna has admitted it, is that they want to introduce a platform for modifying all kinds of proteins in the body, all kinds of proteins. And those include receptor proteins in the nervous system. Someday we could go into more detail. But these receptors are the key to behavior and personality, because these are the way in which the neurons in the brain talk to each other through neurotransmitters and the receptors that receive them as signals. Okay, so that's what I have on Geert Vandenbosch.
Yeah, how would we know if what he is afraid of would actually be starting to happen? What would be the signs?
Well, if there are a lot of variants that are circumventing the vaccines that they've rolled out, that would be one key. I think that's what he's concerned about. I think that's what he believes he sees.
Well, people should be alert for that.
Yeah. Hey, you sent me something just this morning regarding a statistical analysis being done by an agency up in Canada. And what they're seeing now is that the numbers of deaths due to the lockdown that can be attributed to the policies of the government involving lockdowns and social distancing, etc., are climbing above what one could say are due directly to COVID infections. Do you want to comment on
that?
Well,
sure. I mean, I have been saying all along that the clearest signal the public had that there was malevolence with the corona response was that the government didn't produce any analysis, any of the governments throughout the world, produce any analysis indicating that the effects of the lockdown were not going to be more severe than what would happen if we simply allowed nature to take its course. Now, there have been a tremendous amount of interest in this as far as poverty, what effects poverty has on health and mortality. In the 70s and 80s, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Goes to these statistics and points out that the effects of 1 million people facing unemployment has a statistically verified rate of increased mortality beyond anything that corona represents for the human race. And therefore, the government should have engaged in a exposition of this question about which is worse, a lockdown or the unemployment, before the lockdown, or at least during the first months of it, when they were talking about a very brief period of time being locked down to flatten the curve. So that discussion never occurred. The public was never made to think clearly about this question. And now, and in fact, there's been a couple statisticians. The one from John Hopkins, I think her last name was Breon, pointed out some information about this and then was quickly kind of taken off the internet. Well, now this is a Canadian statistical organization. I haven't really vetted it. I don't know. I just got the article this morning, but it seems very straightforward. They're just saying that the lockdown is causing more deaths than it is preventing. And I'll give you just a data point just to give you how clear this is. Fentanyl overdose, just the one drug, the fentanyl, the super heroin that has been plaguing us over the last couple of years, it had was responsible for around 40,000 suicides and or excuse me overdose deaths in 2017, and now even though they don't produce the suicide statistics at this point, you can see from some of the other areas like the U.S. Customs statistics that fentanyl use is up over 500%. Now, if the mortality rate tracks the increase in the fentanyl statistic of being smuggled over the border that the custom people are picking up, that would be a mortality level. Basically, it would absorb all of the over mortality numbers. In other words, they show that there is an increase beyond what they have as a baseline anticipated mortality occurrence in the United States. But if the fentanyl overdose deaths just track the customs statistics as far as drug smuggling, then we are already at 100% of that number just in the overdose, and that isn't even getting into the increase in suicides. So anyway, this is really a scandal. The government has not given the public the tools to be able to look at the situation clearly. And it's something that everyone needs to start thinking about. Are the effects of the lockdown far greater than anything that the corona represented as a threat?
Right. And, I worked for a government agency, and as far back as 2008 or so, I got into a tug of war with one of their lawyers. In some of the documents I was writing, enforcement documents, I was using the phrase for the protection of public health and the environment, and they insisted on putting environment before public health.
Interesting.
So also I noticed around 2000, something happened around 2013, 14 or something, and I could see a real change. This is during the Obama administration, of course. I could feel a real change in the overall direction of the attitude of the government towards people and the citizens. You know, I was insisting on trying to develop this idea of our service to the citizens and empowering the citizens and businesses to be the front line of public health and things. And they really didn't like that, I could tell. So, you know, this problem that we're having with the real killer being the lockdown is that we, early in this COVID thing, we got off onto the wrong foot, in my opinion. In my opinion, when this arose, we should have seen medical scientists being funded, and they would, of course, leap to the opportunity to start identifying the virus, isolating the virus, look at the pathophysiology of the virus. But really, very quickly, the epidemiologists took control of this. And these are people sitting behind computers. These are people like the fellow in the UK with his modeling. And so it's as though whoever is controlling this with lots of money, they realized that the modeling, they learned from the climate change stuff that you could get away with a lot by modeling. And so that's what really drove this. And then they backed themselves into some corners, and then they had to make the whole story revolve around their models, not around basic biologists and pathologists using things like electron microscopy and good immunological techniques and microbiological techniques to isolate this virus from the tissues, let's say, of autopsied material, and then clearly identify which tissues it was attacking. Is it really SARS-CoV-2 virus, or is it really a mixture of viruses that look like it? What was going on there? And I don't believe they did it. It's very hard to find that kind of material online, which it should be very easy.
Yeah, and you know, just to interject, this is basically part of the obfuscation that occurred with the PCR test. Because with the PCR test, they were using a 40 cycle, evidently, of amplification, which creates massive false positives. So now when you get to mortality, you have the idea of, well, all you need is a positive PCR test, and there you can call it a COVID death. But had they had the kind of science in place you're referring to, they could have done you know, the things that sort of identified it more precisely.
Right. You want to cross-reference studies that have imagery and immunology along with these genetic studies. And even the developer of PCR, we've mentioned him a number of times, Gary Mullis, God rest his soul, he just passed away about a year ago. Year and a half ago, he himself said that the PCR should never be used as a diagnostic test for disease. And you know, it's come up personally in my life. In fact, I'm dealing with it today.
Yeah, tell us about this, David. You've been communicating me about this problem you've having. It's a fascinating story. Can you give the public a little synopsis of it and the meaning of it?
Yeah. So one of my physicians has prescribed a screening test. You know, one of the hobbies that people develop as they're getting older is having medical exams, you know, and procedures. So The requirement is that I have a test for the COVID. So I called the hospital last Friday and I asked them what the deal is, what kind of test they'll use, and they explained it's a PCR test. And I asked them what the cycle threshold is. It's called the CT number, capital C, small t. You could think of it as the number of counts that the PCR test is iterated through. So the PCR, well, I don't even like calling it a test. And Carrie Mullis pointed out that it shouldn't be called a test. It's a method for amplifying genetic material, DNA. So in the case of the coronavirus, which is an RNA-based virus, the RNA has to be turned back into cDNA. You could think of it as a re-engineering of DNA from RNA, and then the PCR test multiplies that DNA. So you get a doubling of the DNA essentially every cycle of the test. And that's really great. If you're looking to find, is there DNA there? It's very useful in crime studies, right? Forensics. And it's also an extremely useful tool for biologists that are studying different aspects of living systems. And it's very good for looking for needles in a haystack, genetic needles in a haystack. That's what it's good for. The problem is that there's lots of different kind of needles and thumbtacks and nails, etc., in those haystacks. And if you multiply this stuff too many times, you essentially lose specificity. You magnify a lot of noise. In the world of microscopy, they have the term empty magnification. And so that's sort of like what you're going. That's what you're doing. Anyone who's worked with electronics knows about amplifying signals so much that you're essentially looking at shot noise, thermal noise when you've turned up the dial too much. So the PCR test has on the front of it, to use this kind of machine analogy, it has a dial, so to speak, and they can dial it up or they can dial it down. So the cycle threshold tells them how many replications are necessary in order to achieve a certain number of a certain amount of DNA. And there's disputes about whether that's useful diagnostically or for staging the severity of the disease. But you could think of it this way: if you want to make something look like a pandemic, and you want to spill a bunch of fear porn on the public, then what you do is you just dial that way up, and you catch a lot of things other than the needle in the haystack that you're looking for. You could, loosely call these false positives. Indeed, they are false positives. So that's what you do if you want to create the appearance of a pandemic where there really is none. This is not truly a pandemic of great severity. But then on the other hand, let's say you're a laboratory that's been contracted out to do these studies for a hospital and for physicians. They want to sell these different types of survey or screening exams. So my guess is that the laboratories are not going to be inclined to really crank up that dial, but to rather make the test more stringent so that there are fewer false positives. And so I called the actual laboratory. It's out of state, by the way. They ship this out of state, which is that already raises some questions in my mind. So they ship it out of state to this corporation that does these analyses. And I called them, and I spent all told that from the hospital and this laboratory, I spent from 11 in the morning till late in the afternoon trying to get an answer. And finally, a receptionist came back and told me, no, they would not tell me the CT number that would be used. Now, Governor DeSantis in Florida early on insisted that when PCR tests are done, that they be reported with the CT number. They were doing what I expect bureaucracies to do, having seen how they work from the inside. You know, like at one point I'm talking to the one woman, and we're having a, you know, good conversation, good communication link. And then she starts, when she felt herself, yeah, I could tell, felt herself backed into a corner, she started saying, "What? Are you there? Are you there? I can't hear you." You know, and I'm checking my phone. I mean, my mute button is fine. I toggled back and forth. So those are just the little things that happen when you press on these systems a little bit. And, this is an example of things that the public can do, which are not, I mean, it's not like the French Revolution, you know, we're not. I mean, it's very
Dave, let me just interject with, like, I think I've been through this problem, and I just wanted to give what I think is the response that all the citizens can do. Go to your local politicians, and I mean the Board of Supervisors, your mayor, just the lowest fruit you can go down the political tree, and ask that individual to find out what the cycle number is on the PCR test that's being used. Because what will happen is he won't be able to get it.
Right.
And that then will help you start convincing this person that you're dealing with malevolence. And I just think that, you know, we can't really get at the higher level politicians are part of the problem. But we can start educating and getting more production out of the lower down guys. And this is a great way to introduce them to the problem. In my local case, the Board of Supervisors were simply astonished when they found out that the PCR test was giving false positives potentially, and that they couldn't get the information.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, it's, you know, when we talk about false positive, it's false positive. It makes sense if you talk about forcing this technique into a diagnostic setting, where it doesn't belong, according to Mullis. I mean, if you're a biologist and you're trying to study things and ask, is there this DNA in there? You tell yourself, well, I have this degree of confidence, or this degree of confidence. Maybe it's higher, maybe it's lower. Oh, okay. You know, in other words, you use it as a tool with full knowledge of, what it is finding and what it might not be finding. What I think is that this leads into our last kind of two topics, and that it leads into it because it involves what we can do as the public. And so the next topic, I think, is that of propaganda. We have to realize that we're dealing with a propaganda operation, a psyop operation, psychological warfare operation, like none that has ever been waged against the public. And I would invite our listeners, if you're listening now, you've found our podcast site at Podomatic. And if you'd look, you'd see there's about a half dozen podcasts that we have posted. And I have Podomatic provides for a thematic picture to be associated with each one. And I would, I really put a lot of effort into these, pictures. I take these myself. I'm not taking some stock photo off online somewhere. And so back in November, I was visiting some friends in, California, and they very generously allowed me to stay overnight. And, I noticed in their dryer room on the, top of the dryer, were these, what I'm told are called dryer balls. And these are things you throw in the dryer to make the clothes fluff up. And they look like, children's toys or dog toys. You know, they're rubber balls, and, they have these little spikes on them. And I said, oh my gosh, this looks like very similar to the kind of, things that, were being shown repeatedly as part of the propaganda campaign of the coronavirus. To make us believe that it really is everywhere. They post it on every news site almost and everywhere else. And I think people know what they are. So if you look at that site, you'll see these blue-colored dryer balls. Now, in the first image that I showed on an early podcast, I've focused on the dryer balls themselves. And there's nothing else in the picture. You can't really tell that they're on the surface of a dryer. They look like, I mean, it's, the effect is kind of nice. They look like they're floating in some ether, you know, mysteriously. And I don't tell you that those are meant to represent coronaviruses. I let the viewer assume it. And, the neat thing is that when you look at the second instance of a photograph with those dryer balls in it, I've provided more context. You can see that it's the top of a dryer. You can see the lint door. You can see the stacked towels. You immediately know, oh my gosh, that's what I'm looking at. So it goes back to something I've been familiar with since I was studying ethology, animal behavior in graduate school. I even wrote about it in my dissertation. And that is the concept of object and surround, or object and context. And this is something that the propagandists play with. When you see the contextual information of towels and dryers in the laundry room, you reinterpret, or you should reinterpret, what those dryer balls are. But it's interesting. I had a conversation with a friend, and I asked what the second image, you know, spoke about, and this person said, "Well, I don't know what you're saying. Maybe you're saying that somehow the coronavirus needs to be cleaned up or laundered." Well, they said, "I'm not sure." A little fuzzy. So you see, what's happened there is that these masters of propaganda have so penetrated the minds of the people with that image as being a representation of the coronavirus that they will go to great lengths in many cases to use the picture of the dryer balls to reinterpret the context, not the other way around. And so, what we really need to learn to do is how to reinterpret when we are being provided new contextual information, new information that says, hey, that original thing that you saw, there was deception involved there. Or at the very least, lack of adequate information. To some degree, I mean, when a scientist looks at nature or a historian looks at past events, this is what we're doing. I mean, we all should be revisionists, always updating our understanding of the world. And so this is an invitation to people to do that.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, particularly at this point where there is this issue of, you know, as some of the topics we've just gone through, that you could have malevolence. And I know this is a really hard thing for people to have as kind of a, you know, to back to your point of changing the perspective.
It's painful for them.
It's very painful, but I just think at this point, people need to have it as a possibility. I don't think it's appropriate to say, well, I've got the answers, or Dave is a person you should look into. But
right.
I think there is enough evidence that a normal sort of understanding of the world would give you the concern that we have to start thinking about this possibility. And when you do, I guarantee you, I mean, this would be my opinion, the world will start to make a lot more sense. You'll be able to do a lot more. For example, like with the vaccine, someone who has this understanding of the potential of malevolence would look at all of the strange things that are kind of part of what has been brought to us with this vaccine concept that they're rolling out for us, and would never take the vaccine. Because right. once you put into all of the other problems that are associated with it, the possibility that there is malevolence, right?
Yeah.
Then suddenly the whole reasoning behind taking it disappears.
I noticed, I've been noticing over the last, 15 years really, mainly because of working in the government and then trying to deal with topics about what the government was doing, that it's very hard to move people to a greater understanding because they have an almost infantile desire to treat authorities as mommy and daddy. And this is part of the pain that they experience when you ask them to question things about the guy. I showed one person, I got them thinking about 9/11 and Building 7. And many people today don't know what Building 7 is. I just had that experience with a flight attendant a few weeks ago. And I remember the individual said, I refuse. They make an act of deliberate will. I refuse to believe that our government could do something like that or overlook something like that. And, you know, so the other thing is, Joe, is to finish up, because we always try to give people two things at the end, bring them out of purgatory so that they can see that there's some hope.
Yeah.
And also to give them tools of things that they personally can do. So I think because of this podcast, I had a group of university students invite me. They invited me and had dinner, and they asked me to give a talk. So we spent about, 3 hours together. And at a restaurant off campus, because they can't get faculty approval. At zero. Yeah. I mean, they had one individual consider it, but then he expressed his fear of losing his job. So this just tells you how captured our universities are, and we know that. I mean, we know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
The beauty of this group is, I mean, they are energetic, and they are one of the things I saw that really impressed me was that there wasn't much I had to do. This isn't an engineering project on our part. It emerges naturally from the human being to say, hey, something's wrong. What could we do? So, you know, it wasn't about COVID alone. It was about the whole ball of wax, about the whole cultural war that's been waged in general on human beings, and very specifically on Europeans.
Yeah, how cultural Marxism, which, you know, which is a very identifiable philosophy, is in fact a kind of racial attack against Europeans. And when you look at 9-1-1, when you look at these symmetrical collapsing buildings, you have to ask yourself, is this something related to this attack? Because once you start to get into this hidden world, the world that has been kept from us, you have to start plugging things in. You have to try to come to a clearer understanding of the world just for self-defense, for heaven's sake, you know? So, yeah. This is, you know, where we are when we approach COVID. We have a whole history of malevolence, in my opinion, that we have to bring into our understanding, you know, of this situation. And that really underlines just how dangerous the situation is we're facing. Because what it suggests is, falls right out of this understanding, is that this is a kind of Georgia Guidestone depopulation, process that we're involved with.
Right. And then, again, just to underscore this, the desire to introduce into our bodies and, into our culture as well, the idea of these pharmaceutical products, again, that can be a open door platform for introducing genetic modification. Not that necessarily these vaccines are going to do that. In fact, I think they're probably going to try and make these very benign so that we buy into them in the future. But, you know, again, back to the student group, one of the delightful things about it is they were so hungry for information. I just went through my bookshelves and I pulled off a list of about 80 books, some of them classics, some of them recent things that can alert them to just what we're talking about here, the scene behind the scene. And, you know, the classics are, that's what saved me, Aristotle and Aquinas. And even the book of the apocalypse in the Bible, if you read those things, they give you the filters, the necessary filters for looking at events and like a good detective or confessor or spiritual director or any type of investigator saying, oh, wait a second, something is wrong here. Something doesn't fit. Because certainly these universities have failed quite intentionally to provide young people with these necessary tools. So
absolutely, and you know, of course, they try to stop their thinking with the idea of conspiracy theory. But I would note your insight as an antidote to that, which is to say that if you look at nature, there's always or often there would be someone or a particular individual within a species whose role would be to look out for unseen, like dangers that the rest of the group is not aware of.
This vigilant bird.
This is the role. Yeah. This is the role that we're actually trying to get. It isn't the idea of like, well, we're trying to go into some sort of dark place with just psychological problems, you know. Look, this is a normal thing. This is a normal activity for us to be concerned, to have questionings and to try to see if there are conspiracies, in fact, operating against us.
Indeed. Right. So what we're looking at when we're dealing with conspiracies is what we see in the biological world as an analog among other species is both predator-prey relationships and pathogenic relationships, you know? So, you know, our churches have become so sappy with this, you know, these kind of infantilized ideas of it's all about love and forgiveness, and there is love and forgiveness, but you also need the hard story about there being real devils out there. And,
right.
And you know, you could think of on the spiritual level, the diabolical, and on the political level, the hidden societies and the biological level. The common analogical theme there is predator and prey.
And that's just a great way to conclude our discussion. Dave, thank you so much for this. Do you have any final thoughts?
Well, I thank people for giving us their attention. And by all means, remember that a well-lived life really requires both theory and practice. It requires thought, and it requires conversation. But it also requires prudent action. Prudence is not synonymous with inaction. Prudence is the definition of prudence is right action at the right time for the right reason to the right degree.
Oh, that sounds wisdom itself, Dave. Well, thank you very much, and we'll be talking together soon. All right.
Good talking with you, Joe.
Good talking to you this morning. Talk to you soon, Dave.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye.